which becomes very important for assimilation and otherwise. These statistics you will find in the works or any statistics about Jews you want before the First World War. You will find in the works of the man who founded Jewish statistics, Arthur Rupin, which are in the library in translation, and you will find it and you'll find all sorts of statistics. I want to be brief. By 1933, for example, and this is probably the most meaningful thing about social distribution, among the German Jews, there were as many doctors as tailors. Now that is very significant if you think about the distribution in Eastern Europe and even to a certain extent in France, where the tailors would outnumber the doctors 10 to 1 or more than that. Among German Jews, there were as many doctors than tailors. Yes, that's neat, I agree. True, though. 46% were independent businesses. And the thing about those businesses are, again, 46% independent businesses where the rest of the family did not help. That means businesses which were larger, not little family businesses. The distribution in Eastern Europe and in France to a certain extent were small independent businesses, where the whole family helped, as you will know from the family book chart or from your own history. In Germany, 46% of Jews had their own business where the rest of the family did not help or participate. 8% were workers and 1% were domestics. Some other statistics. Among the 100 richest Jews in Prussia, 23 were Jews. But as Jews were settled in Berlin, that's very high for a denomination which among a population of 10 million and 100,000. That's very high. But it's still higher. For among the 10 greatest fortunes in Berlin, I told you the concentration was in Berlin. Among the 10 greatest fortunes in Berlin, 8 were Jews. They were led by the descendants of Moses Mendelssohn, the bankhaus of Mendelssohn Bartholdy. Of these 8, 4 were baptized Jews, but taken by everybody else as Jews, like Mendelssohn, for example. 4 were bankers, private banking. The richest, the bankhaus of Mendelssohn, the third richest, the bankhaus of Arnold in Dresden. 2 were industry, very extraordinary. Only in Germany did Jews important in heavy industry. 1, the second richest man in Berlin, was the founder and proprietor of the greatest Silesian coal mine, and indeed dominated the entire Silesian mining industry. The second richest, the second industrialist, was heavy steel in the Rhineland. Heavy steel in the Rhineland. 1 was a newspaper proprietor, but who made his money in advertising, introduced advertising to Germany. Well, you might as well know my grandfather. Now, the richest, nothing left of that. I'm taking this, that these statistics are 1911 about Berlin. The richest, now, these riches are relative, and I'll give you a final one. The richest person in Germany, not surprising, in 1911, were the Krupp family. 137 million gold marks. The richest Jewish fortunes in Berlin were between 40 and 43 million gold marks. I stress that. For today, that would be 10 times the value in dollars. So between the Krupp and the Jewish fortunes, there was quite a difference. A final statistic, which was just dug up for me, is income tax. Income tax in Berlin in 1900. I have to take Berlin here. There are no Jews who did not pay income tax, first of all. And the percentage of income tax paid for Jews is about twice as much as the percentage of income tax paid for everyone else. It's broken down in Protestant, Catholic, and Jews. It's about twice as much. 24,411 Berlin Jews paid 40% of the entire Berlin income tax. And that were not just the big fortunes who by and large managed to pay very little income tax in those days. That is more your independent shopkeeper. Now these statistics I think make clear what I mentioned, by the way, that the structure of the German Jewish community was lopsided. That until the second half of the 19th century, when you had the immigration from Eastern Europe, it was a singularly wealthy outfit. A singularly wealthy outfit in every way. From Moses Mendelssohn's time until the 1920s, because inflation and depression will take their toll. But until the 1920s, as I say, out of the 10 greatest fortunes in Berlin, 8 were Jewish. And indeed, the income tax again shows you that there were very few poor Jews. Only 9%. You can add 8% of workers to 1% of domestics. And you get 9% of what you would say people who were poor. But in Eastern Europe, the whole picture would be utterly reversed. Utterly reversed. And in France, I don't know, Mr. Weinberg knows all about the Façonniers, the picture would be also quite different. I think in France, there would be the big Jewish fortune, probably, the same thing, but there would be much more poor Jews than in Germany, right? Much more. I think a much higher percentage. This also has to do with the acceptance of reform against orthodoxy and all of this. But as some of you questioned it, decided to do a little research and give you some statistical answer, at any rate. Now, I said second of all that I would answer some questions today as we have finished with emancipation and assimilation, or would you rather wait till Friday? Would you rather have me go on with anti-Semitism or begin with anti-Semitism? I see the sigh of relief now that I get to anti-Semitism. It'll be something a little easier for you. But it's not that complex as the other. The other was very strange to you. This won't, I think, be so strange to you. Yes?
So the income tax in Germany at that time was progressive, or?
The income tax that existed nominally was progressive, but only mildly so, and as far as the rich were concerned, they could get out of it by making charitable foundations. But the charitable foundations which they made were never entirely for Jews. They were always for Jews and Christians. Yes. Yes, one more, yeah.
Why do you conclude it? Because 40% of the income Berlin debts paid by Jews, therefore the Jews made more money. Isn't there an alternate conclusion that therefore the Jews paid their income tax?
No. I know that from my family history. They were as dishonest as everybody else. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. That's forever. For example, if I may be personal, my grandfather, who is among these 8 largest Berlin fortunes, paid very little income tax, but founded many institutions for Jews and Christians, specifically for Jews and Christians, orphans, apprentices. Still today, whenever I go to Berlin, I have to visit them. I'm an honorary visitor of about 4 such institutions. The bad food smell is dreadful.
Institutions that were reformed, did they ever
No, they were made up as part of emancipation. It was spent for, to cause something only for Jews. It is quite true that these rich people, as I told you before, gave some money to Jewish orphanage institutions, so that the Jewish orphans, who there were, and in Germany there weren't that many, could be trained to be peasants and soldiers. Yes, yes, they all gave that. There's a very famous one in Arnhem, which still exists, to train them to be peasants and soldiers. But their main charitable foundations were charitable foundations which were interconfessional. As I take from this example, a hospital, a home for apprentices, and an orphanage, a mixed orphanage, which exists to this very day, of course. And there are many such foundations. The Nazis took down the pictures, that's all. I mean, the pictures of the foundation. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, they are both in their own way, a matter of degree. Italy and Austria were more emancipated, but the Italian Jews, as you will see, never had to cope with much anti-Semitism, while the Austrian Jews had to cope with a great deal of anti-Semitism and a great deal of other problems because of the great immigration from Galicia. So that the original Austrian Jews, with their patriotism, were soon very besieged. We shall come into that when we come to the rolling incident, to a very famous anti-Semitic incident, which the native Jews did not want to fight at all, but they were under pressure from the immigrants from Galicia. The Italian Jews never really had any anti-Semitic pressure. Never, properly speaking. Not since 1870, really. Yes?
Is there a distinction that can be made between political and personal emancipation?
There is and there isn't. The people who wanted or accepted emancipation wanted both. But in reality, as I said last time, the Mendelssohn family was always thought Jewish. You'll see why when I go on now. Social emancipation after the Romantic movement was never a success again. That is to say, during the Romantic movement, until 1840, it must be said to be a success. Moses Mendelssohn's children moved in the really German cultural society and intermarried and all this. But after 1840, it wasn't any more a success. And indeed, anybody would include the bankhouse of Mendelssohn or the bankhouse of Arnold under Jewish bankers. See what I mean? And in effect, the social circle of these people was entirely Jewish. Right? You know, in those days, you don't do this anymore, but in those days, people kept guest books. Is that still a concept to you? Where people who came visiting wrote. And we have the guest books of all these circles. And by and large, Jews visited with Jews, whether baptized or not. Especially from 1850 on. Yes. You'll see, you know. It was never as exclusive as it is in America. That is to say, never anywhere in Europe did you have Jewish clubs like Rossinger's or indeed this kind of division, obviously. That you didn't have. It was more an unspoken thing. Jewish country clubs didn't exist. Country clubs didn't exist. The Jewish country clubs didn't exist. But there wasn't any other exclusion, except that you couldn't become a state official and an officer. But otherwise, there were no exclusively, nominally exclusive Jewish institutions, social institutions, or nominally exclusive Gentile social institutions. It just worked out that way. Yes?
The only military path of the militia is passed.
Yes.
Do you have anything more on those memoirs of the Mendelssohn or anything similar?
Unfortunately, Mendelssohn is translated, as I said, to Jerusalem. It's, however, quite expensive. It's not a Schocken paperback, it's a Schocken hardback. And you can read that. There is a book by a man called Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, called The Making of the Modern Jew. which is about German assimilation, which I think is not really that good, but it gives you the essence of it. That's the other book, in English, I would have to say. Meyer, what's the first name? No, I forget. M-E-Y-E-R. It's not bad, it'll give you an idea, it has some good quotations in it anyway. Now about France in English, I think there's nothing. Nothing at all. About Italy, the passages of Cecil Roth, R-O-T-A, History of the Italian Jews, the final chapter. I will tell you a little about it, but not much. Again, the only good thing there in Italian, there's nothing in English. I'm sorry to tell you, Mr. Sachs, that the difficulty we have, that the English and American branch of Jewry and I lumped them together, for certain reasons have been the most anti-intellectual branches of Jewry. Therefore, you don't have hardly anything in English. You see what I mean? I'm sorry, it's true. It's true. It's true. It would be impossible in Europe to go into a Jewish house and not find books. But I have been in houses in America of Jews in Chicago suburbs, not in Madison, in Chicago suburbs and elsewhere with the white Cadillac before the door, but not a book in the house. That's impossible. That doesn't exist. It's just unknown. Yeah.
Well, then come to our house.
Our
house.
Well, good. But it is nevertheless true that the American Jewish community and the British Jewish community, that's very interesting, and we'll come to that, are of all the Jewish communities the least intellectual. That may be because of their surroundings. That may be because of their true, I'm just telling you truth. You want to escape, you want to change it, that's why you're in this course. I want you to change it. So anyway, however that might be, I think I'll postpone the rest of the questions then to Friday, because otherwise I'll never get up to the 1939 at all. And begin therefore with the thing that we have left out, the pressure of anti-Semitism as reflected in the problem of assimilation, which is related, as I said before, to the Jewish time symbolized by the ghetto. But if we view the history of modern anti-Semitism, we see in it more than merely a clash between cultures. The clash between cultures, which I talked about, undoubtedly existed. But the history of anti-Semitism is more than the clash between cultures. We realize that the hatred of the Jew is not merely connected with the European reaction, but is above all connected with the democratic impulses of the 19th century. We know that anti-Semitism was part of the protest against emancipation, of the European reaction, of those who disliked the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and whom we call the conservative reaction. But this conservative reaction, which opposed emancipation, was never violent against the Jews. Never. Instead, it was a refined resistance. For the aristocracy of Europe, which made up this reaction, feared violence, feared mass movements, believed in hierarchy, in the Christian state, in the status quo. Therefore, they did not encourage public anti-Semitism, which they viewed with singular distaste as a mass movement, as something that might lead to violence. Instead, they advocated legal restrictions. Instead, they went in for social ostracism. These conservatives were Christians. That is to say, and I will come back to that, they never believed in doing away with the Jew. They believed in separating him out, but they never believed, of course, in any kind of a final solution. Conservative anti-Semitism, then, has a Christian base. It's designed to stop encroachment upon the status quo, upon the traditional hierarchies. The idea was that Judaism corrupted Christianity, that Judaism was modernity. And now I'm giving you the best quote I'll ever give you throughout this course. So if you can make a contribution, you can. In 1849, the leading conservative of the day, Adam Miller, had this to say, and it is very typical, but it is also a wonderful quotation for this kind of outlook. In 1849, the Jewish Messiah, the Antichrist, has come to earth in the guise of the steam engine, and this in order to speed up the end of the world. That links it for you. That the Jewish Messiah, the Antichrist, has come down to earth in the guise of the steam engine, and that to speed the end of the world. In other words, the Jews stand for modernity, the end of the world in conservative terms. For conservatives, the state was the Christian state, whether Protestant or Catholic. The monarch was a Christian institution created by God. Obviously, here the Jews have no place. But what is the answer? The answer is the Christian answer, baptism. Baptism washes away corruption, washes away the steam engine. And so it comes about that the leading conservative Christian theoretician in Prussia was a Jew, Julius Stahl. Hear more about him later. Julius Stahl, whose maiden name I have now forgotten, but it was Löw. It was Löbel. Julius Stahl, who converted from Löbel and who became, in fact, the leading conservative Christian theoretician in Prussia, and who was accepted by the Conservative Party in Prussia as a leading member of their leadership. Baptism is the answer. We must not forget that. Conservative and Christian anti-Semitism was never violent. It was exclusion, and that exclusion could be ended by baptism. What one did, one avoided Jews, but that was all that one did. And that will continue into National Socialism. The Prussian aristocracy, the real old Prussian aristocracy, opposed National Socialism, obviously, a mass movement, a democratic movement, a violent movement, a potential attack on the status quo, on hierarchies. And it opposed equally violent anti-Semitism and Nazi anti-Semitism, because that was also mass and violent. All that one did about the Jews, one avoided them. That is all. Nothing more. That is the conservative anti-Semitism. It will accompany us. It will last. It will last. But it must be sharply distinct from that anti-Semitism which will be really important to us. That anti-Semitism that to us will be of prime importance. That anti-Semitism, which we might call linked to democratic or populist movements, for the future is in this democratic anti-Semitism, not in the conservative anti-Semitism. This democratic anti-Semitism was linked equally to left and right. It is linked to the new nationalism, but it is also linked to certain tendencies in socialism, to both. That is why your this time reading is important here. For the first thing that we must notice about this democratic anti-Semitism, the anti-Semitism of the future, is that anti-capitalism and anti-Semitism were deeply intertwined. And that this intertwining of anti-capitalism and anti-Semitism, which was valid for the left as well as for the right, has the future before it. For both left and right, both the growing socialism and the new nationalism, share anti-capitalist feeling, if in different ways, if on a different basis. The Jew was the anti-producer. He was the anti-producer, as you will see in a minute, for Karl Marx, for Proudhon, and for Father Jahn in Germany. In other words, the Jew as anti-producer runs from Proudhon over Marx to the new nationalism, to Father Jahn as well. It runs the whole government. Now, what has happened here? Finance capitalism is involved, banking especially. And again, there was here a kernel of reality, anti-capitalism and anti-Semitism have been the same since the Middle Ages, since the Jew was the moneylender. But now it was true that finance capitalism was pioneered by Jews, names which you all know, Rothschild. Now I gather a sort of culture hero, not then. The French family of Pereira, similar. And there were many others, the Mendelssohn family. Finance capitalism, banking. Now, why is that so serious? Why is that so serious? You say some of my best friends are bankers. Very serious. First of all, because left and right could unite here. Both were against finance capitalism. And the right was not against other forms of capitalism, but everybody was against finance capitalism. That you could unite. But the other thing is, it lends itself to conspiracy theory. For who knows what international bankers do? You use it today. International bankers then were what you call American corporate capitalism. Terrible conspiracy. You know, shudders go around your back when you say American corporate capitalism is invading something else. Well, that's the international banker in our period. Similarly. Why? Nobody knows what they do. I mean, it's a very refined and technical thing. They have their big buildings, and they deal in money, and there are wars and peace they are set to determine. So, before you had this wonderful slogan of American corporate capitalism, it was the international banker. And it was the international Jewish banker, because they were mostly Jewish, so why not? This plays in to the second difficulty, the stock exchange. Now, not most stock exchange people were Jews, but a hell of a lot of Jews were stock exchange people. Another thing. Another good conspiracy thing, for who knows what really goes on there. There are all these Jews shouting back and forth, and prices rise and prices fall, and the international bankers sit there. So obviously this is a Jewish conspiracy. But I want to make clear to you is that the anti-capitalism has moved. First it was in the Middle Ages and so on, the Jewish moneylender. That's not very frightening. You go to a little Jew and he sits there and he counts out his rubles. That you can understand. He charges perhaps too much interest, but that's something you can understand. That doesn't lend itself to conspiracy theory. But now, prices rise, prices fall, wars are fought, innocent people are slaughtered because of international finance. There were, remember, crashes in which people lost their money. The stock exchange is similarly shrouded with secrecy. The result is that this new anti-capitalism connected the Jew straight away with secrecy and conspiracy. This comes out of the nature of Jewish financial activity, international banking, and the stock exchange. After all, the man on the street doesn't understand that. To him, it's a conspiracy. This fuses with the accusation, to which I shall come back, that the Jews are a state within a state. That accusation, to which I shall come back, fuses with this idea of conspiracy. And lastly, the ghetto image fuses. For from 1860 on, from a literature to which I shall come, the international Jewish conspiracy, this mix of rabbis, Rothschilds, Pereirs, stock exchange people, meet in the Jewish cemetery in Prague. Why? Because the ghetto stereotype comes in. This is mysterious. This is frightening. I don't know how many of you have been to the Jewish cemetery in Prague. How many have visited it? Well, you visited at dawn or dusk when you don't see the buildings around it, which are new. It's frightening. Didn't you think so? It's mysterious. It's odd. So that makes a great deal of sense, again, in this sense. That's where the international bankers and the rabbis met when we come to the great document of this conspiracy, the Protocol of the Elders of Zion. When we study that a little, you will see that that enters into it. Anti-capitalism, then, becomes of the greatest importance, and that, again, must be quite clear in that regard. It took in the left and the right. The great and fundamental book, unfortunately not translated, was written by a socialist, by a follower, in fact, of Fourier, about whom you will read. It was written by the Fourierist. Fourierism was very anti-Semitic. Tussenel, with the famous title, The Jews as Kings of the Epoch. Le Juif Roi de l'Epoque of 1854. And it's typical for this common bond of left and right that this book by Tussenel, The Jews, the Kings of the Epoch, was promptly reprinted in Germany, was used by all sorts of rightist movements, and was used, in fact, across the board, from France to Germany, everywhere else. The thesis of Tussenel is what I have just told you. The Jews are the king of the epoch through what we would call finance capitalism. But that makes it, of course, very sophisticated. Through being international bankers and controlling the stock exchange and therefore being a state within a state. That is Tussenel, and it went all over Europe. I now want to devote some time to socialism, and I want to devote some time to socialism and anti-Semitism a little later. But I want to say some things about it right now, before I come to the details, because it fits in with what I have just said. For this kind of anti-Semitism, socialist or of the right, is built upon the demythologizing of Christianity. In other words, the ideological preconception, preconditions, are the attack of on Christianity, above all, of the young Hegelian. That is Strauss's book on Christ,
getting the myth out of Christianity, attacking Christianity. That is it. Now, this attack on Christianity, which came in the odd 1840s, as some of you may remember, by the young Hegelians, was meant to lead to a radical emancipation of the Jews, to be sure, for many of them, at least at first. But in reality, it removed any barrier to a deepened collective stigma. What do I mean? Christianity was never violent against the Jews in the sense of doing away with them. The conservatives didn't want to do away with Jews. They were Christians. And no Christian wants to do away with Jews. It is the Enlightenment which had the slogan, cease to be a Jew, and the Enlightenment was anti-Christian. Why can not Christianity ever have a final solution? That is built into Christian theology. After all, the Jews must be kept alive as witnesses to the wrath of God. The Jews must be kept alive as witnesses to those who rejected Christ. If there were no Jews, the Easter Mass would be incomprehensible. The Easter Mass with its famous phrase, the Jews as the damned people. Now taken out of the Vatican II, everything is being eroded. But in the Easter Mass, the Jews are the damned people from time immemorial. You had to keep them artificially as witness. That is why the ghetto, that is why the papal idea of ghetto. You separated out Jews, but you did not exterminate either Jews or Judaism. But now that Christianity was under attack in the 1840s, that barrier was being removed. And what might lead to radical emancipation, because Jews must cease to be Jews, could also eventually lead to radical extermination. For after all, the Christian barrier was gone for many of these thinkers, left and right. The idea was that Jews must cease being Jews. A fundamentally un-Christian attitude, fundamentally not possible in Christian theology, through baptism too, but the bulk of Jews must remain as a witnesses. Therefore, the new anti-Semitism plays into, or is based in a sense, on this attack on Christianity. The result was that the reasons for Judaism's existence are now secular. It is one thing to say Jews exist because God has wanted them to exist. Jews exist because God wants examples, and they must have a miserable existence to show how miserable are the people who reject Christ. But they still have an existence that is beyond anything in this world. Once Christianity was attacked by the young Hegelians, especially in the 1840s, you could say, why do Jews exist? Jews exist for concrete reasons. All right, remove these concrete reasons and Jews will cease to exist. You see what I'm talking about? Quite a different attitude. What are the concrete reasons? No longer God. The concrete reasons why Jews exist, I want to say, with one word, money. It is based, both left and right, on this idea, which fuses with the international better. Here, let me take the normative document, which comes from no less than Moses Hess, before his Zionism, well, obviously. Moses Hess wrote in the 1840s, as a young Hegelian, a famous piece, an essay on money. And the point that Moses has made is the point on which Marx based his speech on the Jews, to which I shall come in a minute. The point of Moses Hess is as follows. It is called On the Essence of Money. I come here again into a difficulty. Very little of this has been translated. And to make an anti-Semitic reader, I'd be in difficulty. I think. Very little of this has been translated. And of course, that part of Moses Hess, he's a precursor of Zionism, that's forgotten. But it's nevertheless important. You can't get it anywhere, that essay on money. I have a copy. If you read German, I'll gladly let you read it. Now, what is Moses Hess's point? That will summarize what we're getting into here. The point is that money is the symbol of human alienation. Well, not very uncommon, new then. And what is money? Money is the Jew. Who invented money? Who deal with money? Who manipulate money? The Jews are the people of money, as Hess puts it, and as I translate it, the people of money. The Jews are therefore the symbol of alienation. But it also follows, if you end the tyranny of money, you end the Jews. Because they are the people of money, end the tyranny of money, and Jews will cease to exist. This is Hess before his turn to Zionism. This is more important, the influence of this group of young Hegelians, who were again attacking Christianity and Judaism, as Christianity and Judaism have been attacked in the Enlightenment. They emphasize the overcoming of Judaism. From this point of view, I think what is important for you at the moment, that Marx and Hess based themselves on the Enlightenment tradition, on the Dome tradition. You remember I talked to you about Dome. Jews must cease to be Jews. They must become productive and therefore be re-educated. That we have been over, have we not? But this is now deepened among the young Hegelians. For Hess and for Marx, ending the Jews also ends alienation. Let us look for a minute at something we get back to, Marx's 1844 tract on the Jews. Marx's 1844 tract on the Jews was based directly on Hess, his friend then, the essence of money. But what Marx says is the same thing. The Jew typifies the worst aspects of capitalism, the fetishism of goods. He goes one step further. The Jew typifies not only money, but the fetishism of goods. Love of money, devotion to commerce. And indeed, for Marx, what is the Jewish religion? The Jewish religion is the objectification of commercial transactions. For as Marx put it, and many others, the Jewish religion is full of bargains. Covenant. God is always covenanting with somebody, remember? And so the Jewish religion is for Marx, and will be for all of socialism to this day, the objectification of commercial transactions. That is to say, the Jew was poisoned from the beginning, for his very religion is merely a commercial transaction. And from then on, everything he does is a commercial transaction. He is a creature of the fetishism of goods and all of that. Marx, therefore, wrote with several things in mind, which lead us again to this anti-Semitism. And it can be duplicated on the right,
and I will do so very soon. First of all, the idea that there is now a secular cause which produces the Jews means Jews can be abolished if you remove the cause that produces them. This you couldn't do in Christian anti-Semitism. Can't remove God. Secondly, the secular cause is connected with the deep linking of Jews and money, which dates from the Middle Ages, which is deepened by the development of finance capitalism, which was indeed dominated by Jews and the stock exchange. Thirdly, this led to conspiracy theories, for unfortunately, these are financial matters not easily understood by the naked eye, and therefore lend themselves to conspiracy theories. Lastly, as far as socialism is concerned, the essence comes with the young Hegelians, and with the attack on Christianity once more, as there had been attack on Christianity on the Enlightenment, in the Enlightenment. But now it is deepened. The Jew must be re-educated, Judaism must cease. The Enlightenment had believed that, but now Jews are squarely the people of money. Their religion is in the form of a commercial transaction. They have the fetishism of goods. They are, in fact, a stereotype. And the shadow of the ghetto lies over this again, because we know that Marx shared the ghetto stereotype. Marx, in his letters, had a vocabulary which was always anti-Semitic in the way that it was anti-ghetto. What Marx didn't have to say about Eastern European Jews, if you're a Marxist, you better not read that. He had things to say about Eastern European Jews that were pretty bad. In other words, he had the ghetto stereotype, and how, in all his letters, that is quite clear. Jews freed from Judaism will become productive, for all of these anti-Semitism took over the idea of productivity from the past. Money is not productive. Productive, as for the Enlightenment, is manual work, is work, is good, something you can see. Not money. That's a very old prejudice, but still very strong. Strongest among the early socialists, who were very archaic in this regard. That money is not productive. And the Jews must become productive. Now let me make clear finally, we don't have self-hate here. I am going, for your benefit, to devote a considerable section later to the problem of Jewish self-hate. We don't have self-hate here with Marx. We don't have self-hate here with Hess. Why not? Because the Jews were part of a total world. Individual Jews were not hated. Marx said nothing but Jewish friends, for that matter. It is rather that Jews, Judaism, as a group, as a religion, comes into a totality of the socialist view of the world. And what I just have told you about Jews will remain part of socialism. Dukovsky, to whose Jewish question we shall come, it will remain a total commitment on the part of the communists. That is the background for Soviet anti-Semitism that I have just given you. But with that, I will continue next time.